back though. Is everyone ready? Everyone settled? Very good. So now we will begin to look at the Mahayana proper. We have spent the first day and the first hour of today looking at the origins of the Mahayana, looking at the Theravada tradition and looking at the historical background, which I think is worth doing, especially as many of you are from a Theravada background, so I think it's important that you should understand the linkage, the connection between the Theravada tradition and the Mahayana tradition. But from now on, we will turn our attention directly to the Mahayana tradition. And first of all, we will look at the Mahayana Sutra literature. And of course, it will not be possible for us to look at all the Mahayana Sutra literature because it is vast. There are a great many texts. So I have selected three principal texts which we will study over the course of the next few days, over the course of the rest of this week. And the three texts that I have selected are the Lotus Sutra, the Sadharma Pundarika, the Heart Sutra, or the Heart of Wisdom Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, and the Lankavatara Sutra. And we will also be looking at some excerpts from the Diamond Sutra or the Vajra Chedika Sutra, which is also a Prajnaparamita Sutra, a Perfection of Wisdom discourse. Now, I want to begin by pointing out that there are many, many Mahayana Sutra texts. And they are primarily of two varieties. There are a number of what we call transitional texts, which are not precisely Mahayana texts, but which are bridging texts. You can say they're texts that bridge the Theravada tradition, or the Hinayana tradition, or the Abhidharmika tradition. It's interesting that this morning there were several questions about the schools. Is this school a Mahayana school? Is it a Hinayana school or an Abhidharmika school? The fact of the matter is that when you classify, automatically, in order to classify, in order to call a school Mahayana or Hinayana, you have to leave something out. You have to draw a somewhat artificial boundary. Now, certainly there are Mahayana tendencies in the Mahasanghika school. There are Mahayana tendencies in the Sarvastivada school. There are some suggestions of the Mahayana ideas in the Vatiputriya doctrine. Similarly, in the Sutrantika attitude. But we don't call these Mahayana schools per se. We don't call these schools fully fledged Mahayana schools. They are transitional schools. They're schools that bridge the gap between the Staviravada, the Theravada, and the Mahayana. They're schools that formed stepping stones, if you like, footsteps, if you like, toward a full-fledged Mahayana. So the point there to remember is that we don't all of a sudden have a transition from day to night or from night to day. It isn't like crossing the date line. You don't suddenly have Mahayana, full-fledged Mahayana. You cannot draw a single line between Theravada / Hinayana on the one hand and Mahayana on the other hand. There are intermediate stages of development, and that's what I was trying to do yesterday. to talk a little bit about the intermediate steps, the developments that took place between the conservative position of the Staviravada, Theravada, and the Mahayana position. So now we come to talk about Mahayana itself, and even here we have texts that we can regard as transitional texts, texts like the Lalita Vistara, texts like the Mahavastu, which were texts that belonged to the Mahasanghikas and to their satellite schools, because the Mahasanghikas were also not a single school, they were a collection of schools. But my purpose now is not to prolong or to elaborate this discussion of transitional schools and transitional texts too long, because I want to get on to the real subject of this course, which is the basic doctrines of the Mahayana. So I think that we have done enough in the way of bridge building. I think we've done enough in the way of showing how there was an evolution, a development of Mahayana out of, or side by side with the development and evolution of Theravada schools, so that we don't need to do any more of that. If you have particular questions, then please, I will try to leave time for questions, not only in the individual lectures, but I will try to put aside an hour or two later in the week so that you can ask any questions that you might have. So in the meantime, if you have any questions, just make a mental note or note them down on a piece of paper, so that when we do have time for questions, I can put aside an hour or two for questions. At that point, then you can bring up those questions and those doubts that you have, and we can talk about them more thoroughly. The fact is that there are, as I said, a great many Mahayana sutras. The three that I have selected to study in some depth are important, and they are representative, and that's why I've chosen those three. But in addition to those three, there are a number of other very important Mahayana sutras. Sutras like the Ratnakuta Sutta, which is a very early text. It is, in fact, a collection of some 40 short sutras, and it contains a lot of important germinal elements of the Mahayana, a lot of important doctrines of the Mahayana. And in addition, there are other texts like the Samadhiraja Sutra, which is a text about emptiness. It falls into the emptiness category of texts, the texts that teach emptiness, like the Perfection of Wisdom text. We have a text like the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, which is a delightful text, a beautiful text. It's a text that we have a complete translation of in English. In fact, we have a couple of translations. We have one translation done from the Chinese by Charles Look, if I'm not mistaken. And we have another translation done from the Tibetan by Robert Thurman. And this is a delightful text. This is a text which is something similar to the Lotus Sutra in many ways. The Vimalakirti Nirdesha describes and extols the figure of the householder Bodhisattva. This is one of the characteristics of the Mahayana, that although monks and the monastic community continue to be important in the Mahayana, they are not exclusively important. And the figure of the householder Bodhisattva also becomes very important. And this figure is at the heart, at the center of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. Vimalakirti is in fact the name of a highly developed, highly mature householder bodhisattva, endowed with many extraordinary powers. Then you have texts like the Dashabhumika, which talks about the 10 stages on the bodhisattva path, the 10 stages to Buddhahood. Just as for the path to arhatship, we have 4 stages, stream winner, and so forth. In the Mahayana tradition, we have 10 stages on the path to Buddhahood. So the Dashabhumika treats that issue, treats that aspect of the Mahayana tradition. Unfortunately, I don't think we have an English translation of the Dashabhumika. Similarly, we have a text like the Sandinirmochana, which is a text that bridges the gap between texts that teach mind, the importance of mind, the primacy of mind, and texts that teach emptiness. I should say at this point that the Mahayana sutras tend to fall into 3 categories. One being a general description of the Mahayana practices and the attitude of the Mahayana toward issues like the nature of the Buddha and so forth, and that deal with the career of the Bodhisattva. We have sutras that deal with emptiness, shunyata, and we have sutras that deal with mind only, with the primacy of consciousness, with chittamatra, consciousness only. So these are the three varieties of Mahayana sutras. I've actually, my selection of the Sudharma Pundarika, the Prajnaparamita, and the Lankavatara reflects these three categories or these three classes of Mahayana sutras. Sudharma Pundarika is generally about Mahayana doctrines, about the nature of the Buddha and so forth, and the way that the Buddha operates to teach living beings. The Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita, Hridaya Sutra, and the Diamond Sutra deal with the theme of emptiness, and the Lankavatara Sutra deals with the theme of the primacy or the importance, the character, the nature of consciousness, nature of mind, with mind only. All these Mahayana texts are composed in Sanskrit or in mixed Sanskrit. And these texts are all very large. This is why they are generally referred to as the Vaipulya Sutras, or the extensive sutras, the voluminous sutras. Now, the Heart Sutra is an exception to these, because the Heart Sutra is very short. But the Heart Sutra is a kind of abridgment or condensation of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras that are longer. And we have Perfection of Wisdom sutras that are in fact very long. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about the style of the Mahayana sutras. In addition to being very voluminous, very long, another important characteristic of the Mahayana sutras is that they make extensive use of parables and similes. Now, we have already seen that even in the Theravada texts, parables and similes are very important. We've just come across several parables and similes taken from the Theravada texts in the first hour this morning. We've come across the parable of the water snake, the parable of the raft, the parable of the elephant and the blind man, the parable of the wounded man. So the Buddha made liberal use of parables and similes in all his discourses, whether they are discourses that we find in the Theravada canon or whether they are Mahayana sutras. But the Mahayana sutras are particularly liberal in their use of parable and similes. Similarly, the Mahayana sutras are discursive and didactic. What I mean by that is that the Mahayana sutras do not argue points. The Mahayana sutras do not give you reasons for their conceptions of the nature of the Buddha. They don't give you reasons for their declaration of the emptiness of all factors. They don't give you reasons why the mind is the architect, the mind is the constructor of the whole world, of all of reality. By and large, they don't give you specific and logical and systematic reasons for these doctrines. They simply state these doctrines. They tell you these doctrines. They teach you these doctrines. The task of justifying, giving reasons, explaining these doctrines with reference to reasons and other logical and systematic systems, the task of this falls to what we call in Mahayana the Shastra literature. And the Shastra literature are texts composed by masters, not the words of the Buddha, not believed by the Mahayana tradition to be the words of the Buddha, but the explanations of great masters, masters such as Nagarjuna, Asanga, Vasubandhu. Of course, in the case of Asanga, the line between the words of the Buddha and the words of a great master is a little bit blurred, because Asanga is believed to have received his teachings from the Buddha to be, the future Buddha Maitreya. But the Shastra literature is the literature that takes up the teachings of the Mahayana sutras and explains them with the help of reasoning, systematizes them, presents them in a more systematic form. Because if you look, when you look at the excerpts from the Mahayana sutra literature that I'll be giving you, you'll see that the sutras themselves are not very systematic. There's a lot of repetition, there's a lot of going back to previous arguments, taking up earlier arguments, elaborating them further, changing subjects, going on to another subject. They're not particularly systematic. They are voluminous. They make substantial use of simile and parable. They're not very systematic, and they're not they don't usually bother to give logical reasons or arguments for the teachings that they present. So this you need to know about the Mahayana sutras. Now, I just say one very little bit about the importance of the sutras, and once again about the importance of patience. Mrs. Santino pointed out that even in the Pali text there is a lot of repetition, and that this repetition was beneficial for memorization. In the Mahayana sutras there's even more repetition. The sutras tend to be even longer. There is a lot of elaboration. Nonetheless, there is no substitute for reading the sutras, or the suttas if they happen to be in the Pali language. I started my study of Buddhism by reading Pali suttas, and I still prefer and like to go back to reading the discourses, the Pali discourses or the Mahayana discourses. I like to do that because in general, reading the discourses, reading the words of the Buddha is worth 10 lectures like this or more, and it is worth several, you know, many, many books that are written by scholars and various exponents of the Dharma. You want to really get to the heart of the teaching of the Buddha, read the suttas, read the sutras, read the Pali Suttas and the Mahayana Sutras, read the words of the Buddha. It will require patience, but you aren't expected to read them all at one go. You can take your time, you can read a little bit every day. In general, our problem today as modern people is that we are used to and we have come to expect everything to occur instantly, everything to occur quickly. And in the matter of religion, it doesn't happen that way. In the matter of realization, it doesn't happen that way. It takes patience and it takes time and quiet contemplation. And in a way, the repetition that you find in the discourses is useful because it forces you to go slowly. It forces us to assimilate the teachings with a calm and a tranquil mind, not to hurry, not to hurry along the path, because if you hurry along the path, you are liable to stumble. You're liable to take the wrong turning. So the point is to go slowly and to study carefully, sincerely, and then of course to reflect, to ponder in the last discourse about the Dharma and the assembly of the wrath and so forth. You notice it said several times to ponder upon the teachings, to consider the teachings. So it's not only a question of hearing or reading, it's a question of thinking about the teachings as well. Okay, so I'll now turn my attention to the Lotus Sutra as such, the Sudama Pundarika. In many ways, the Lotus Sutra is the fundamental sutra of the Mahayana. It is the central sutra of the Mahayana. It has had a tremendous degree of popularity throughout the lands of the Mahayana. It is very popular, continues to be very popular in China, in Korea, in Japan, and it had a great popularity in India, very popular in Tibet. Throughout the Mahayana countries, the Lotus Sutra has been fundamental and popular. And among the reasons why it has been popular is also the fact that it includes in its later portions a chapter devoted to the very, very much beloved Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, and he of course is very, very popular in Tibet. He is the patron deity, if you like, of Tibet. The Dalai Lama is believed to be a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, and he is also extremely popular, as you know, in China and in Japan. So the Lotus Sutra also contains a chapter devoted to the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. I don't know whether we will have time to look at that chapter. If we have time, maybe we can look at that chapter as well. But the fact is that the Lotus Sutra has been an extremely important and extremely popular Mahayana Sutra, and so it was entirely natural and right that we should look first at the Lotus Sutra when we study the Mahayana Sutra literature. Does anybody have any questions at this point? Is what I have said so far clear? Okay, now I want to characterize, you know, the Mahayana tradition in general before we get into the principal themes of the Lotus Sutra. And we have already given sufficient hints of the essence of the Mahayana, of the foundations of the Mahayana. But there is no harm in making those hints specific, in clarifying those hints, and making those hints concrete. And what we have been hinting at in the past 4 hours or so of lectures is that the core of the Mahayana, the essence of the Mahayana, is compassion. Compassion is the fundamental motivation of the Mahayana. And one of the greatest exponents of the Mahayana, Nagarjuna, whom you will be hearing a lot about, not so much this week, but in the second week of the course in January, Nagarjuna, in one of his texts, says that the Mahayana is motivated by compassion. The fundamental motivation of the Mahayana is compassion. Therefore, please do not disparage the Mahayana. Please do not blame the Mahayana. Because the fundamental motivation of the Mahayana is compassion. Now, Nagarjuna, as I suggested yesterday, Nagarjuna was, for the most part, writing for an Abhidharmika audience, a Hinayana audience, a Stavira-vada / Theravada audience, call it what you like. Let's just maybe opt for the least controversial name for what came before the Mahayana and just call it pre-Mahayana. He was writing for a pre-Mahayana audience. He was writing by and large for an audience that was not yet converted to the Mahayana. And his purpose was to convert this audience to the Mahayana. And so naturally among some of the persons who were not yet converted to the Mahayana or who did not yet accept the Mahayana, there was a tendency to blame or to criticize the Mahayana. And Nagarjuna particularly warns against this, and he says, don't criticize, don't disparage the Mahayana, because the principal motivation, the fundamental motivation of the Mahayana is compassion. And this I always tell my students, many of whom are from Theravada backgrounds, and when I teach the Mahayana to them, I always tell them, don't disparage the Mahayana, don't criticize the Mahayana, because the basic motivation of the Mahayana is compassion. And I personally believe that. I have a profound appreciation of the Mahayana. I respect the Mahayana. I try my best to practice in the Mahayana tradition. And that, of course, does not mean that I don't equally respect the Theravada tradition. I told you yesterday that to practice the Mahayana, you have to practice the Theravada as well. But even I, who am sympathetic to the Mahayana, do come across aspects of the Mahayana, certain statements and certain sutras, certain practices of the Mahayana that generate in me some doubt, some perplexity. I have to admit that when I see some, and I'm not going to specify what those practices or teachings are now, if they happen to come up in the course of the teaching or in the course of the discussion, then I will identify them. But in general, I can say that there are certain aspects of the Mahayana that strike me as being maybe a little over the top, maybe being a little exaggerated, maybe being a little bit too liberal, too flamboyant. But I forgive that. I forgive that. I overlook that because the motivation is compassion. And all right, let me give you a concrete example, because then you will understand what I mean. If I leave it in general, you may not understand my meaning. What I mean, for example, is that most of you will be familiar with this Japanese sect that is most commonly known as Nichiren, right? You're familiar with this school, I suppose. Now, a lot of people in the West and elsewhere, a lot of people who come to me and say, well, I was approached by Nichiren, and what do you think? Should I follow the Nichiren practice and so forth? I would never, ever recommend to anyone who is starting out in Buddhism to follow Nichiren. I would never recommend that. I think that it is a very marginal school. It's a school that is just on the edge of Buddhism. It misses out on a lot of basic Buddhist teachings. So this is a manifestation, this is a development of a Mahayana school, which goes, as far as I'm concerned, in my humble opinion, it goes very close to the edge, if not over the edge. But I also know for a fact that people who began their connection with Buddhism with Nichiren have, in the course of time, crossed over and begun to study more mainstream Buddhism and practice more mainstream Buddhism. So even Nichiren, with all its peculiarity, with all its bizarre characteristics, with all its dubious credentials to be a real Buddhist school, even Nichiren can serve as a bridge. It can serve as a hook to bring people into Buddhism. So that's why we close an eye to some of these extreme or dubious developments within the Mahayana. We close an eye to them because we realize that they can also be a bridge to bring people to the mainstream Buddhist teachings. So compassion is central to this. People are very, as even according to the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Buddha says, people are sunk in attachment. They have a lot of dust in their eyes, they have dull faculties and so forth. To bring these kind of people to Buddhism, you need a lot of skill and means. You need a lot of clever and intelligent methods to bring them into the Buddhist tradition, to bring them into the Buddhist fold. So because of compassion, the Mahayana bends over backwards. It makes allowances. It forgives. It is tolerant of even dubious practices, because it believes that step by step, little by little, these people will be brought into the Buddhist fold. They will be brought into the Buddhist tradition, the real teachings of the Buddha. So what are the principal themes of the Lotus Sutra? One of the principal themes of the Lotus Sutra is all about the Mahayana conception of the Buddha. Who was the Buddha? What was the Buddha? How do we conceive of the Buddha? We already talked about this a little bit yesterday. We already said that even according to the Theravada tradition, the Buddha is a super ordinary, an extraordinary, a super mundane being. That he's not just an ordinary person like you or I, and he is also not like the arhats, he is greater than the arhats. But the Mahayana has a different, a much more radical, a much more ample, a much greater conception of the nature of the Buddha. For the Mahayana, the Buddha is a transcendental, supramundane being. In some ways, it's even we need to put inverted commas around the term being, also, as you will see now as we talk about the Mahayana conception of the Buddha, as it appears in the Lotus Sutra, and this is generally accepted throughout the Mahayana tradition. The conception of the Buddha is quite different from the common conception of the Buddha in the Theravada, and from the common conception of the Buddha, even among people who know a little bit about Buddhism, who've come into contact with Buddhism. The conception that we find in the Lotus Sutra, expressed in the Lotus Sutra, and throughout the Mahayana, the notion of the Buddha that we find in this tradition is very different from what we find in the Theravada tradition. And when I say it's very different, it is an expansion of the quality of being extraordinary, of the supramundane, the notion of the supramundane nature of the Buddha. But in general, we can say that for the Lotus Sutra and for the Mahayana, the Buddha Shakyamuni is just one manifestation of the Buddha. The historical Buddha Shakyamuni is just, if you like, an emanation, a puppet, a dramatist, a play actor. The life, the birth, the life, and the passing away of the Buddha Shakyamuni is just a soteriological drama. Soteriological, excuse me, it's a technical term. It means it's a drama meant to liberate living beings, meant to free living beings. It is not a real, they're not real events. The birth, the career, the passing into parinirvana of the Buddha Shakyamuni is just a play put on by the transcendental Buddha for the emancipation of living beings. This is the Lotus Sutra's view of the Buddha Shakyamuni. That doesn't diminish the importance of the Buddha Shakyamuni. The Buddha Shakyamuni is the most important Buddha for our age, for our generation. What this is talking about is not the importance of the Buddha Shakyamuni, whether the Buddha Shakyamuni was, you know, what, actually it enhances rather than diminishes the importance of the Buddha Shakyamuni, because it makes what the Buddha Shakyamuni did part of a larger story, and it expands, it transcends the boundaries of the Buddha Shakyamuni. It transcends the traditionally accepted boundaries or limitations of the life and teaching of the career of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And it does, as a matter of fact, explain a lot of these anomalies, one of which one of you pointed out yesterday. How could the compassionate Buddha, who was able to live for an aeon, how could he enter into parinirvana simply because Ananda neglected to request him to stay? This seems inconceivable. Similarly, how could the Buddha Shakyamuni hesitate to teach? How could he hesitate to teach? He had been practicing for countless lifetimes to become a Buddha. I mean, this would be like someone undergoing a long, long, long course of training to become what? A university professor? To become a jet pilot? To become an astrophysicist? And then after he graduates, he says, oh, well, I think I'm just going to live in a log cabin in the woods. I'm not going to fly any planes. I'm not going to teach any courses. I'm just going to retire after he completes his course. It doesn't make, as such, it hardly makes any sense. It makes sense insofar as it serves to emphasize the difficulty of the Dharma, the difficulty of the teaching, the fact that the Dharma is not easy to understand. But it hardly makes sense as a real choice for the Buddha to teach or not to teach. If he wasn't going to teach, then he ought to have practiced to become a Pratyeka Buddha, not a Buddha. So a lot of this is explained by a view of the Buddha as, of the Buddha Shakyamuni, as a manifestation of a transcendental Buddha. Now, unfortunately, all we have to communicate with are words, and words are very problematic. That's why, according to one story, the Buddha held up a flower and Mahakasyapa understood the meaning. Mind-to-mind communication is preferable. Not having the powers of the Buddha and Mahakasyapa, we have to rely upon words. And this word transcendental is one that is difficult for some people to understand. I'm not entirely sure that it is the right word, but it is the only word that we really know, that we really use. But there is a parable, again, there is a story in the Lotus Sutra in chapter 16 that explains the life, career, and passing away of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And the title of the chapter is the Lifespan of the Tathagata, which of course gives you an accurate suggestion of the topic, of the subject matter of the chapter, but the parable or the story is what will help more to communicate the nature of the Mahayana view of the Buddha. And the story in the parable is of a wise physician. And I will just recount it briefly at this point because it is one of the excerpts which we will look at in detail. So at this point I think I will just touch upon the salient features, the most important features of the story or of the parable. The parable talks about a wise physician who has been away on business in a neighboring country. And when he returns, he finds that his sons have, through their foolishness and their ignorance, taken poison. And so all his sons are very ill, and some of them are out of their minds. And so when he sees the situation, the physician prepares a medicine for his sons. And he gives the medicine to his sons. And some of his sons take the medicine straight away and are cured of their disease and become healthy. But some of his sons are so ill that they have lost control of their minds, that they have become insane, demented, delirious, and they don't want to take the medicine. They refuse to take the medicine. So the physician thinks, now what shall I do? There are some of these sons of mine who, although this medicine can cure them, they refuse to take it because they are delirious. They are out of their minds because of the effects of the poison that they have taken. So he thinks of an expedient means. This is another one of the main themes of the Lotus Sutra, the use of expedient means or skillful means or expedient method. There are many different translations different ways of putting this. The term is upaya kushalya or kushala upaya. And it's not new to the Mahayana. It exists in the Theravada tradition. I'll tell you, I'll describe to you a couple of examples from the Theravada tradition of the use of skillful means this afternoon. The physician thinks of a device, of an expedient means. And so he tells his sons that I'm getting on in age now, I'm quite old, but I have to go and take care of this last important piece of business in a neighboring country, so I will go and take care of that business. And so he leaves. And once, after he has gone away, he has a note sent back to his country saying that he has died in this foreign country. Now, at that point, all his sons, both those who have been cured and those who are still sick, they all grieve bitterly. But particularly the ones who are sick are very upset because they think, well, if our father was here, he could cure us. But now he's abandoned us and he has gone off and died in a foreign country. And now what are we going to do? How are we going to get cured? And then they remember the medicine. And they think, well, now our father is no longer here. All he has done is left this medicine. We had better take this medicine. So they take the medicine, and they're cured. And then when they're all cured, the father comes back, and there's a happy family reunion. So what is the message of the story? The message of the story is that if the Buddha had lived for an eon, or for 3, or for 10, or for an eternity, if we knew that the Buddha was there in India, or in China, or in Tibet, or wherever, we would become lazy. We would become lazy. We would say, why? We don't have to worry about practicing the Dharma because the Buddha is there. We can always go to the Buddha. We can always receive teachings. The Buddha is there to hold our hand. The Buddha is there to help us. So the point of the Buddha's passing into Parinirvana was to get people to move, because otherwise people of little virtue would just say, all right, there's lots of time. The Buddha is there. He's always there. We don't have to hurry. We don't have to practice. We don't have to work out our own salvation with diligence because the Buddha is there to help us, and the Buddha is going to be there forever. So the passing into Parinirvana from the Mahayana point of view is just an expedient device. It's just a way to get those of us who are out of our minds with the poison of the afflictions, with the poison of ignorance, greed, and aversion, to get us to take the medicine, the only thing that we have, the Dharma. That's what the Buddha left behind. We have the medicine, we can take it, and we have to take it because the Buddha has passed away. The Buddha has disappeared. The Buddha is gone. But the Buddha is not really gone. The Buddha never really went anywhere. The whole story of the Buddha's birth, his teaching, his passing away, this was all a play. This was all a little drama that the transcendental Buddha, that the eternal Buddha, that the Buddha that is always there, put on for our benefit. He put on this play for our benefit. This 6 years of asceticism when he became so thin that he could grasp his backbone through the skin of his stomach, that was all a play. That was all a drama that the Buddha put on for our benefit, to show us how to become enlightened, how to understand the Dharma. So the Buddha never really abandoned us. The Buddha is still there, will always be there. And this is the point in the Lotus Sutra, that the Buddha is actually always there. That Shakyamuni was just a manifestation of the Buddha. He was just an appearance of the Buddha. Just as the Buddha was able, the Buddha Shakyamuni, on the level of ordinary reality, was able to create the figure of that lovely young maiden in order to convert Queen Kshema. In the same way, the transcendental supramundane Buddha was able to create the manifestation, create the appearance of the Buddha Shakyamuni, create the appearance of the Bodhisattva Siddhartha Gautama, Prince Siddhartha, the ascetic Gautama, the whole unfolding of the life of the terrestrial Buddha, the Nirmanakaya Buddha, because after all, this is the appearance Buddha, the Buddha that appears on the earth. The whole lifetime of the Buddha Shakyamuni, the whole career of the Buddha Shakyamuni, is just a demonstration. It's a demonstration. It's like one of those films that they show you, you know, how to become a jet pilot or something like that. Look at this film, you'll get an idea. And that is what happened. I mean, the Buddha Shakyamuni is only a manifestation of this inconceivable, unimaginable, inexpressible, transcendental Buddha whose lifespan is immeasurable, who has been enlightened for countless aeons, and who will continue to be enlightened, and who, as a matter of fact, actually also still is among us. This is also suggested that if only we had pure faculties, if only we had little dust in our eyes, we could still go to the Vulture Peak in Rajagriha in India and see the Buddha Shakyamuni preaching. He's still there preaching. You and I go there, we just see a dusty town, you know, we see a few, right? Nothing much, someone trying to take your money, someone trying to cheat you. Yes. That's what we see. But if we had pure faculties, we would see the Buddha Shakyamuni teaching the Dharma. So this is the Mahayana conception. This is why yesterday I was saying, everybody agrees the Buddha was supramundane. How supramundane? How transcendental? According to the Mahayana, the Buddha is absolutely transcendental. And the sutra goes on to illustrate this point in various ways. So I think now it's probably time for me to stop, and I can continue in the afternoon. But this is just the beginning of some of the wonders of the Mahayana teaching.